360.
It's been said that science fiction and fantasy are two different things.
The line separating fictional genres can be blurry, as Rod Serling noted on The Twilight Zone in 1962.
Science fiction, the improbable made possible. Fantasy, the impossible made probable. What would you have if you put these two different things together?
Well, what you'd have is speculative fiction. It's an umbrella term that's kind of taken off during the last couple of decades. Lots of writers and readers prefer it to the older, narrower genre definitions. It encompasses not just sci-fi and fantasy, but magical realism, horror, counterfactual history, dystopian fiction, anything not strictly normally realistic. Harlan Ellison wrote speculative fiction across a 60-year career, publishing more than 1,700 short stories in his lifetime. He also wrote novels, such as the post-apocalyptic classic A Boy and His Dog. He also wrote movies and worked on a lot of the TV shows I watched growing up, such as The Outer Limits and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. He dreamed up The City on the Edge of Forever, which was the Star Trek episode about time travel to 1930 New York that may be the best of the original series.
Deliberately stop me, Jim. I could have saved her. Do you know what you just did?
He knows, Doctor. He knows.
Harlan Ellison died a few months ago, age 84. I spoke to him back in 2008 when he was the subject of a new documentary called Dreams with Sharp Teeth. I gave him a long, fulsome introduction, and then... Harlan, welcome to Studio 360.
I'm quietly humble and proud to be here. You forgot to mention I'm a snappy dresser and a good dancer.
Well, I tried to stick with the objective descriptions, but so I tried to avoid calling you a science fiction writer.
But which you just did on purpose.
No, I'm referring to what I didn't do.
Look, can I give you the scoop, Toots?
Please, honey.
Okay. For years and years, I have been writing what is best represented as the work by Edgar Allan Poe, Franz Kafka, or the South American writer Jorge Luis Borges. What I write is a kind of twisted, I guess, fantasy. I have never written science fiction. I've occasionally used some of the furniture from that genre, but it's like calling Agatha Christie a railroad writer because she wrote Murder on the Calais Coach.
Yeah.
And I cannot get the words science fiction off me.
Yeah.
What I do is I take the mirror, I reflect back the human heart in conflict with itself, to quote from Faulkner, and I turn the mirror slightly askew. I think it is fascinating to talk about the way people behave and attach a fantastic element to it, the way all storytellers from Aesop on did it. I work in the common grain, as they say.
You mentioned Poe, and looking at your output over this last half century, there's something 19th century about it, just in terms of its incredible size. Why so much?
Well, because I'm a writer, kid. That's what I do. You know, if I were a plumber, and you said, how many toilets have you fixed? And I said, 10,000. You wouldn't say, boy, what a prolific plumber. What the hell else am I supposed to do? I'm a writer.
I read in various biographical sketches of you so many things that sound, some of which sound hard to believe. When you ran away from home, when you left home at 13, did you actually join the carnival?
Absolutely. You know, things sound improbable from a distance. When you get close to them, you find that Einstein said, things should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler. When I was a kid, there was no such thing as running away and joining a rock band. All there was the acoustic guitar. And if you wanted to join a band, you had to go and find Glenn Miller. But as a kid, I had read a book called Toby Tyler, or 10 Weeks with the Circus. And in my time, kids ran away and they joined the circus. But I couldn't find one, but there was a carnival. So I joined the Carney, and I traveled with them for about 6 weeks until we got busted and all wound up in jail in Kansas City. And my mother and father, who, of course, were frantic, they were lovely, lovely people, they were frantic. They hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency to find me. And Pinkerton sent out what they called a Dodger, and a Dodger was a handbill. Have you seen this child? In my picture there. And here I was standing in the lockup in KC, the rest of the Carney having been sprung except for me and the geek. And a turnkey came around and saw me and thought it matched the picture. And he went back and told the desk sergeant. Desk sergeant came in, took a look at me, called Cleveland, and Cleveland sent out a Pinkerton agent on the train, and he came and picked me up and took me home.
I mean, just all of those things, like joining the Carvey, the lockup, the Pinkerton guard, it does sound like an entirely other era.
Oh, it was. But looking back, it was a glorious, adventure-filled time, and it enriched my youth. It also made me tough enough so that when I got to college, however briefly I was there, and they tried to bully me, I would just punch a guy in a kisser and, you know, or hit him over the head with a brick, and it was terrific.
Well, speaking of your love of rich bygone eras, I'd love to have you read a bit from your story, Jeffy, about a boy stuck in a time warp.
I happen to have it in a book of mine called Shatterday. Let me find it here. Well, here's a section after trying to explain this little boy, Jeffy, who his friend grows up, and Jeffy and he, who were the same age when they were children, he's now an adult, sort of watching over Jeffy. And Jeffy has a radio that brings him radio programs from when they were children, Jack Armstrong, Captain Midnight, Tom Mix. And there is a section in the story in which I try to explain this. Hume denied the existence of an absolute space in which each thing has its place. Borges denies the existence of one single time in which all events are linked. Jeffy received radio programs from a place that could not, in logic, in the natural scheme of the space-time universe as conceived by Einstein, exist. But that wasn't all he received. He got mail-order premiums that no one was manufacturing. He read comic books that had been defunct for 3 decades. He saw movies with actors who had been dead for 20 years. He was the receiving terminal for endless joys and pleasures of the past that the world had dropped along the way. On its headlong suicidal flight toward new tomorrows, the world had raised its treasure house of simple happinesses, had poured concrete over its playgrounds, had abandoned its elfin stragglers, and all of it was being impossibly, miraculously shunted back into the present through Jeffy, revivified, updated, the traditions maintained but contemporaneous. Jeffy was the unbidding Aladdin whose very nature formed the magic lampness of his reality, and he took me into his world with him because he trusted me.
That's Harlan Ellison reading from his short story, Jeffy is 5. It's interesting to me, as you were becoming the big deal that you are in the 1960s, that the kind of writing you do was suddenly acquiring cachet from Vonnegut to Borges to the science fiction writers of whom you don't include yourself. What was it about that moment that sort of allowed the world and the establishment to say, hey, this is pretty cool?
As Judge Judy would say, is not an answer. I'm hard-pressed to be able to do that kind of semiotic analysis. I don't know. I suspect it was all in the lieu of Jack Kerouac and the Beat Generation and getting away from World War II and the middle-class outlook in America, that staid, stodgy, electronic hum of the Republican world. It was a time of upheaval. It's easy for far right wingers of the O'Reilly Coulter breed to condemn those years and those decades as nothing but a bunch of idiot flower children streaking in the nude. But in truth, the seeds of everything of value, I think, that we managed to hold on to today in the face of an ongoing stupidification of America are things that were brought to largeness in the 60s and 70s. And I hit right at that moment, and everybody gets their 15 minutes, and I've been very, very lucky. My 15 minutes has lasted since 1955, 56. And though somebody said, "You're not so famous." I said your name to one of my pals, and he said, "Who?" And then I said, "Britney Spears." He said, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "Oh, God." I said, "I'm... you know, if I sought the approbation of monkeys, I imagine I would be concerned about that. But anybody who needs to know my name will also know the name of Guy de Maupassant or Camille or Babe Ruth or anybody else who did what they did on their own terms in their own lifetime and made a mark."
Let's listen to a little bit of Eric Nelson's film about you, Dreams with Sharp Teeth.
You know, people say to me... Even Susan says to me, "My God, does everything make you angry?" I say, "Yeah, everything makes me angry." And they say, "Well, you know, you should be a little mellow, get a little mellow." And I say, "Oh, really? Gee, I had never thought of that. Get a little mellow. Woo, what an epiphany. Like, I enjoy this? You think I enjoy getting up angry every morning, going to bed angry every night, to go through the day with the veins standing out, the bolts unscrewing in my neck? Jesus Christ, I would give anything to be able to be as mellow and cool as most people. I'd be, you know, one of the slaves, and, you know, the Walking Dead, but it would be a relief. Give me 6 months as a Walking Dead, and I'll never say anything angry again."
That is Harlan Ellison in Dreams with Sharp Teeth. Now, there you say you'd like to be mellow. Have you ever tried to do anything about that?
Yeah, I'm mellow most of the time.
Well, no, you are. Even in the time we've talked, I can see that there are certainly...
There's a big... Look, first of all, the word rant has been co-opted by the imbecile internet. A rant used to mean one thing. A panegyric is another. A gardilou is a third. I'm a passionate person. Yeah. I care about things. But at least I have enjoyed myself.
Harlan Ellison, I have entirely enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
You are a cutie pie, and thank your mother for the chicken soup. And my wife and I clutch your antennae and enwrap your cilia with joy.
Yikes! Thanks. As you've just heard, Harlan Ellison was a world-class talker and friendly guy, and he's even more entertaining in my full, unedited, hour-long conversation with him, which you can find and listen to on Studio360.org.